Hi everyone. Welcome to the session on men as allies in the struggle for women's empowerment. My name is Nadeem Mohammed. I am a director and the knowledge lawyer in the employment law department. And I'm joined by my wonderful colleagues, Chris Charter, who's the national practice head of the competition department at CDH, and Gift Kaba, who's an associate in our pro bono department. We're sitting here on the eve of Women's Month, which is August, commemorates the march of a large group, thousands of women, diverse, multiracial group of women, who marched on the 9th of August, 1956 on the Union buildings, demanding reprieve from laws that were both racist and sexist at the time. So I think the timing is quite important for this conversation to take place. And I'm going to start off maybe with a question that leads directly into the topic. The word allyship is used very often in many contexts, especially in relation to people who are marginalized. We have allies, people who are heterosexuals or straight, who say we're allies of LGBTQ people. You have the same with groups who are marginalized on the basis of race. It's also a word that's used very often in relation to women, men as allies to women. But what does this really mean? Maybe if I can ask you to interrogate the word and the concept, and what does it mean for you? I'll start with you, Chris.
I think it's a useful term. I've heard other terms which are far less useful. Manbassador, you know, male champions for empowerment. And I think all of those run the risk of perpetuating the system where men are kind of placed on a pedestal and say, you know, we're a champion for women's rights. And I think to me, allyship in this context is first and foremost nothing more than creating an environment where we can interact with women and women can interact with men in a way which is mutually respectful and effectively, I think, comes down to building key relationships with people, recognizing them at face value and for their own worth. And then in the context of women's empowerment, just removing deliberately any sense of sexism from the atmosphere. I think if you can get that right to begin with, and it's less about, you know, the systems we put in place and the protocols, etc. I think it's more just about saying, we're all in this together. You know, we're all stakeholders in the same game. And there really is no need not to allow anybody to have exactly the same responsibilities and opportunities as the next, and to treat everybody with respect and fairness. And I think if you can start with that, you know, I think you're a long way towards being an ally, not just for women, but for sort of any demographic in the workplace, and working together to share in the mutual benefits of working together.
Gift, your thoughts on this?
I think firstly, Nadeem, I think at this point in time, there can be no question that women face various, you know, systemic challenges, you know, in almost every environment and setting in our society. So we've absolutely got to acknowledge that. And if we are responsible, you know, lawyers, responsible citizens and human beings, I think we've got no choice, you know, but to commit to this significant cause and to commit ourselves to be allies, you know, for change. I think being an ally is not about, you know, heroics or saviorism or dominating the conversation, but really more about commitment, accountability, and us making it a point that we walk shoulder to shoulder with women to find pragmatic, substantive ways to really dismantle these long-standing societal systems, norms, and practices that have prejudiced women for a very long time. So allyship to me is really about accountability, humility, and finding a way to being able to confront uncomfortable truths about ourselves, about our societies and ourselves as human beings. There are ways from an individual level, interpersonal level, and societal level that we can attribute what being an ally means to. And I think we can touch a little bit later on those.
Yeah, thanks for that. So I think what comes out is that it's quite well established that there are quite definitive barriers for women thriving and flourishing in the workplace and in our societies, even though we've made tremendous gains over the last 30 or 40 years, those problems still persist. The patriarchal order in some ways is still very present. But what's important, I think, Gift, as you mentioned, is nothing about us without us. So this idea where men as allies shouldn't replace women in terms of substituting their voice for their own. And I think that's an important thing to remember. And what would you say about that practically? How do men function as allies without usurping the agency of women? Because that in itself becomes highly problematic. And maybe kind of a double question, what does that look like practically and pragmatically in the workplace or in a firm like ours?
There are challenges in exactly what you say. I think maybe one can broadly accept. I know we live in a time when a lot of people tend to not accept the fact that there is difference between the genders, but I think to some extent there is. I think overall, and it's at the risk of being sort of generalistic about it, I think women tend to be more collaborative in their relationships, and their helpfulness in the workplace is more about collaboration and building relationships. Men try to help in the workplace and at home and in society generally by being more action oriented. Men also, and my male colleagues can forgive me for saying so, we generally have lower EQ than women, which means we tend to A, crave credit and we want a little bit of limelight. You know, we feel validated when we are recognized for things, and women sometimes downplay that. So we have those challenges, whereas women don't seek the kind of credit that men feel. So I think there are real things that we as men can do. And people use the term check your privilege. I think it can be a bit of a dangerous term and we can have a conversation about that. But I think just to understand that we come in with certain biases in the way we approach things, and we tend not to listen enough. And I think when you're talking about giving women a voice or acknowledging that, is to acknowledge those differences in approach. And again, for me, it comes back to that sort of equal relationship to say we all look at things differently. And I think if we can get to a point where we're not trying to mansplain, we're not trying to end every conversation by summing it up, you know, when those points have been well made, and really kind of acknowledge where credit is due, because a lot of women will not self-promote to the same extent that men do. And I think it's important for men to be willing to acknowledge and maybe call other men out when they're, you know, taking the credit for someone else.
So the idea of standing up when you need to, stepping aside when you need to, and stepping down when you need to, and to be able to be present enough to know which is the most appropriate in a particular context.
I think education around this topic is quite important. I think for me, practically, it goes back to what Chris and myself were chatting about earlier. You know, you've got to, you know, be accountable to yourself, you know, as an individual first. I think your behavior. I think there are certain, you know, ways or I think attitudes or values that you've got to adopt. Number one, are you silent? You know, because in many ways, silent can be complicit to unsavory behaviors. Like Chris said, if you come across any of your spheres of influence, whether at home or in the office environment, an unsavory joke, a sexist joke, or something like that, what do you do? Do you keep silent or play along to it? So if you let that kind of behavior thrive, then you are also, I think, contributing to the attitudes. Number two, just holding yourself accountable, watching your own behavior, you know, as an individual. Do you create this space to women? Do you create an enabling environment? Do you listen to their concerns? Do you understand these issues or challenges that they are going through? Do you listen without being defensive? And education, you know, educating yourself, you need to understand the challenges that women go through. You need to understand their lived realities. And I think that's really one of the most significant ways that you can, you know, play a role or contribute substantively to the change in attitudes. So not being silent, holding yourself accountable, committing to education.
Thanks, Gift. That's very insightful. I want to go back to a part that Chris mentioned. Chris, you know, you mentioned some of these characteristics that attached or are exhibited more prominently by one gender over the other. So, you know, men tend not to have as high of an emotional intelligence radar as women do, and that comes with its own problems. And, you know, in some ways, men are maybe louder and prouder in ways that are not always productive and that may marginalize women. And, you know, there's been increasing research and data, especially in the social sciences, that these ideas of gender, while they're definitely true and they reflect our environment, they actually learned behaviors. So there's ways in which, because of the way a person is brought up or the material they're exposed to or the pop culture they watch or the way in which their teachers or leaders exhibit themselves, they learn certain behaviors as being normal or natural for a particular gender. What type of culture do you think would help in either undoing that or creating new ideas around what these things mean? That men don't have to act in particular ways and women don't have to act in particular ways in order to demonstrate either masculinity or femininity.
Yeah, I mean, Nadim, you pick up on, a lot of challenges in terms of trying to navigate all of this. I absolutely agree. I think sexism, just like racism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, whatever it is not our natural state. I think it's learned, and it's learned through societal structures. And I think it's useful to think about sexism as a system, which does, of course, privilege men, but it also polices men in a way. So to really sort of start to break down these systems requires, I think, men and women, but men in particular in this context, to be particularly self-aware and to just reflect and understand when you've had a reflex sexist reaction, or to be aware when other men are doing that, and maybe less to tolerate that and more to be a positive influence. It's a difficult situation because I think women don't want and they don't necessarily need to be helped by men. Yeah. And I think that's another thing that comes out of the interactions that I've seen sometimes when we talk about, you know, how can men be champions for women empowerment, is we have the situation where we're trying to do all these positive things. And at worst, it's virtue signaling. But even at best, I don't think it's a healthy situation. I don't know if anybody saw that movie, Formula One. But there's a very interesting scene where there is a woman who is on the pit crew, which I'm led to believe is unusual. And like anybody on a pit crew might do, she makes a mistake and she is castigated for it. And then Brad Pitt's character stands up for her and says, hey guys, leave her alone. You know, she's doing her best. It seemed like the right thing to do. But in a subsequent scene, the same woman comes to Brad Pitt and says, look, I appreciate what you did, but don't do it again. Why is that? She said, it's because it makes it look like I need your help. You know, and I think that's the balance we have to draw here. So it really does, I think, come back to building those relationships and just interacting on an equal footing. I think if you can start getting that right, and it's not always easy, I think we're on the right trajectory.
I think, Chris, an important point there is that for any marginalized group, for the person who's an outsider to that group or does not share any significant identity markers with that group, you should be cautious of a condescending paternalism developing, where they may have whatever noble intentions around standing up or saying certain things, but in a way, it shouldn't come across as suffocating or removing the agency again of the people that you're talking about. Gift?
Thanks, Nadim. I think that's an important point, you know, for all of us to pause, to again appreciate the fact that the end goal, all that we want to achieve, is equality, right, and parity, but not saviorism. So often, because with this topic, it's either you are an expert or you are in the journey of learning, right? So there are always those delicacies, you know, one has got to be conscious of within one's efforts in this cause. So, and to go back to your point, Nadim, about what culture would be or attitudes would be best appropriate to aid in this conversation, I mean, it's a complicated one. For me, I think the most important thing, I think, is education. A lot of this really is within our corners and shadows of our minds, our thoughts, you know, our imaginations, our learned behaviors. So we've got to, you know, be brave enough to be comfortable to question those uncomfortable truths and to learn again about the subject matter and to act importantly. Because sometimes we get this view that these things happen somewhere else or they happen far away from us. But in reality, you know, these behaviors are perpetuated by ourselves, you know, our brothers, you know, our cousins, our fathers. So we've got to be in a position where we are agents in the sense that we are able to act and learn so that we can also teach. Then again, be aware of these delicacies that Chris has referenced, that women don't really need us, you know, they don't need us to help them. What we are wanting to achieve is to dismantle all these patriarchal societal standards so that we get to that position of equity at the end of the day and equality.
Yeah, I think if I can just add on the question of privilege, I think it's a very important part of the equation. And I think it's very important going into, I think, any kind of an interpersonal relationship to understand one's position of privilege. More important than trying to understand one's position of disadvantage, because I think, and this is the dichotomy for me, I am not just male, but white, heterosexual, cisgender male. That's a lot of privilege. And the real privilege is that I never have to worry about whether people's interactions with me has any hidden meaning or hidden agenda. You know, if someone gets my name wrong or if someone makes a joke at my expense, it doesn't go to the fundamentals of my identity and my place in society. That is a huge, huge privilege. And it's important to recognize that other people don't have that same privilege. However, for me to recognize that is not the same, I don't believe, as telling every woman in society that the whole system is rigged against them, you know, because personally, I'm not sure that is entirely true anymore. There are challenges, obviously. I wouldn't get out of bed in the morning if people told me the patriarchal system is rigged against you. There's no point. I don't think it's that so much. And I think that there's a risk in that, which I see playing out, in that it becomes a zero-sum game, this question of empowerment. And wrongly so, because a lot of men withdraw from the conversation because they feel threatened. They feel it's zero sum. They feel it's either going to replace a pro-male society with a pro-female society and someone has to lose out. I don't see why that has to be the case, because I think the paragon here is an inclusive and fair workplace and society, not one which privileges or favors one over the other. And I think if you push the pendulum too far in any direction, we see what I think is playing out in the US. And the US is an interesting bellwether because a lot of the sort of societal trends come out first in the US. And we had, you know, wokeism in the US before it took root everywhere else. And I think I see in the US that pendulum now swinging the other way because it's been badly managed. It's become a binary question. You know, you're either in or you're out. And I think that they've missed a trick there in trying to build kind of a sense of respect and inclusivity. Instead, it's been an us versus them. And I think that's something that as we build and introduce policies towards this, I think it should be based on inclusivity, fairness, and respect, rather than replacing one hegemony with another.
No doubt. So that's a really good observation. But on the part of the US, what I think is also important there is depending in which orbit, and usually language plays an important role. So if you're in an English medium environment that's Western orientated, then the US example looms very large. But for example, if you're in an Asian, Southeast Asian context, usually language doesn't play as important a role. The exposure you have to the culture wars of the US are very different, and the way those translate for you in that context. But the strategy around how these things are employed and deployed and used politically, the US is a good example of what can potentially happen when not done responsibly.
I mean, interestingly enough, there's been some pretty robust scientific studies done by, amongst others, various consultancy groups, Boston and McKinsey and that. And generally the consensus is that a more inclusive economy from a gender perspective is probably worth about $28 trillion worldwide. And if you look at that from a regional perspective, and they've looked at sub-Saharan Africa, and they said if the rest of the countries sub-Saharan Africa just get to the level of their best neighbor, which is not particularly good in terms of gender equality, it's probably a 12% increase in average GDP, right? So there's tremendous upside to building a more inclusive society and workplace. I don't know how we should be measuring this, because I think there's also a temptation to revert to sort of normative measures, to say we want the same number of women in leadership positions as men, for instance. And I think that's certainly something you'd think would shake out eventually. But I don't think that should be the target, because I think really, at the end of the day, people make their own decisions about their careers. And all I would like to see is if someone decides, and again, maybe it's my male privilege, if I decide to check out and open a bookstore in Paternoster, no one says, oh, you lacked ambition and, you know, anything like that, you know, and a lot of women make a personal choice to do other things with their life than be a professional or be a manager. And I think as long as that's their own choice and not because they felt that the system excluded them, and I think it's absolutely, absolutely fine. And I think that paradoxically, you can put a lot of pressure on women in positions of leadership or women who are doing well to say, you may never leave because you're letting the whole side down if you do that. You know, men are still the main and most powerful stakeholders in most organizations. And a lot of these interventions, a lot of these targets are designed and stipulated by men. And then they miss the point altogether. So I just think that at the end of the day, it is about including everybody in the conversation, listening very carefully with respect. And I think if you use the word humility, which is so important, listening, building that conversation more than doing what men always want to do, which is solve the problem. Let's hit a target. Let's do this. Let's introduce this. Let's have a woman's day. Let's do that. I think that misses the point. I think it's just about getting down to our respective humanity and realizing when we're being less than human to other people, calling ourselves out, checking that, and then looking to make sure that other people aren't perpetuating that.
The fundamental ethical reflection around what does inclusion mean? What does presence mean? What does humility mean? I just want to bring it a bit back to the workplace and two very practical things. So the first is the idea of parental leave. So, you know, we've gone some way now as a country in terms of legislation where they've introduced parental leave or a bit more generous parental leave for men, recognizing that men have a role in the nurturing of newborn babies and children, which before wasn't recognized in the same way or acknowledged. But, you know, there was this interesting case that came before our courts where you had a couple who had a child, and the woman, she was self-employed, she had her own business. And so she wasn't in the position to take 4 months off from the business that she ran basically on her own. And her partner then sought to have the 4 month maternity leave or the 6 month, I don't know if it was a more gracious leave policy in that business, to obtain that benefit for nurturing. And the business said no. The employee said, no, you're not entitled, you're not the birthing parent, you're not the mother, you can only get the 10 days. And so the Constitutional Court still has to pronounce on it, but the High Court said, and look again, the 4 months period, which is in our legislation, was meant for two purposes. And again, who decides that the time period is adequate? You know, one was the recovery of the birthing mother. Who says that's enough time or how much time that requires? Who makes that calculation? probably men were again part of that decision making, deciding what is appropriate or not. And second, 4 months of nurturing. So it's nurture and physiological recovery, right? And the High Court said, look, parental unit should be in a position to decide who is the primary nurturer of the child, or if they want to split the leave in any particular ways, that's the more fair option, right? So just that's one view on it. But it's something, many firms and many businesses and many employers don't really question or don't really think about in detail. What does this mean? What does a dress policy mean? Especially when you have a dress policy that's particularly gendered. Men have to wear certain attire, women have to wear certain attire. What does that mean when it comes to these parental obligations? And then connected to that, women, like men, come from backgrounds, right? Gender is not the only identity we have or wear. We have a cultural background, we have a religious background, we have a class background. And there's certain things that coalesce around that. And there's certain expectations that we have based on those other contexts. So a woman, like a man, but we're talking about women, it comes into the workplace, not just as a woman. They come in with all these other identities, right? Race, culture, and other demands on them. How does the workplace meet these women in terms of those demands that they may have or expectations that they may have in relation to how they would like to deal with men based on their cultural background? It is common, for example, for women from certain backgrounds not to want to extend their hand towards men because they find it's inappropriate. How do those ways of being, how is it understood? How is it accommodated? What does that mean for inclusion? So these two things.
I think you've asked two questions, two important questions. I think the first is more sort of nitty gritty, what can organizations do to create systems and opportunities for where we're not just paying lip service to inclusivity and opportunities for women in the workplace, but we're actually putting systems in place that helps. And I think your observation on parental leave is an extremely important one. I would take it one step further than saying, you can decide which parent is going to take it. In some Scandinavian countries, as I understand it, it's actually compulsory that whatever the period is, and they're very progressive, so it's 9 months of parental leave, it's actually required that each person in that relationship must take at least 4 months, right? That's really, really important, I think, potentially, because we can talk about the importance of parental leave and that kind of thing. But the truth is that it does, in a work environment, it is going to set you back somewhat.
Yeah.
Why does it set you back? Because generally it's the men who are in charge and they see the woman going on maternity leave for 4 months. If it was mandated to say that if you have chosen to procreate with someone, you're going to take time off as well, I can guarantee you the men who make the rules will put systems in place to make sure you're not prejudiced because you're out of the office for 4 months.
Yeah.
Those kind of more revolutionary type thinking, I think that for professional service organizations, that we don't have more sort of corporate and professional creches in town, where if you're a caregiver, man or woman, you can drop your kid off at the corporate creche in the morning at 7 o'clock, pick him up at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It's in the neighborhood, practically across the road. You can work a full day without having all those anxieties about my kid.
Correct.
A 45 minute commute away or more, etc. And you can be more productive in the office. That makes it much more easy, I think, for those shared responsibilities at home. And I can talk a lot. I am a parent of 3 children, and there's a lot to be said for how I think society can change in that regard. Your other question, I think, was more about just some of the peculiar challenges of a modern melting pot society where we have to contend not with, simple interaction from a gender perspective. And again, here, obviously, this is part of the problem is I don't have the same kind of insights and experience from a cultural perspective as a lot of people. And those sort of intersectionalities are important, I think, to understand. I, again, don't prefer the term intersectionality because I think it's come to be a little bit of a portmanteau for why life is so hard for certain people in society. And I think that's a healthy way to look at things. But it's useful to understand that in every interaction you have, there is so much more to that than your own perspective. And if I can take one thing out of what she says, again, for people to just be willing to just pause and reflect and say that if a woman is wearing a hijab or if she's reluctant to make eye contact or something, that is not something that I should overlay my cultural experience. And that goes to not just those sort of high level major cultural issues, but just how people have been brought up, whether they're shy. Shyness can be mistaken for being aloof, So just to put yourself in the other person's position and saying, let's just try and not judge, not try and read into people's approach with me, and let's just work together to get the job done. But there are going to be a lot of challenges in terms of narrowing all of those different things up. But I think the more we talk about it, the more we acknowledge it.
And the more we're open to learning.
For sure.
Exactly.
For sure.
Worst thing that I think that these policies and protocols on gender equality can do is make men feel like they are muscling in on the conversation.
Yeah.
You know, and I think you made some important points about men being more willing to listen and not trying to sort of drive the conversation, you know, resisting that temptation to kind of sum up everything and say, right, we have a solution, just listen sometimes. But by the same token, I think there are men who feel it's better and safer to say nothing, safer to stay out of it. And I think that's not healthy either.
I want to conclude with maybe some of your insights or views. We often, especially, you know, in the recent past, maybe it's more common for it to come up, but historically it was an area that people always had a blind spot around, and that is transgender women and trans people. Gender implicates them and implicates them in interesting and usually unusual ways. And many employers, many people usually don't take the struggles or the particular challenges that this group of people face seriously. Or sometimes they're not even, it doesn't even surface in terms of their awareness. What do you think in terms, specifically first as a workplace, but maybe generally more broadly, should we think about in relation to trans people? And in this instance, since we're talking about Women's Month, specifically trans women.
During this conversation, you would have noted that I've been making all of my points and then circling back to education. I think it is important to acknowledge the fact that for the most part, even from the firm's perspective, most men around this subject matter are learners. We are, you know, on the journey of learning. We've got to first acknowledge that. And what that means after we've acknowledged it, you know, it compels us to look into the issues and say, okay, what is it that we're learning? It makes us to interrogate ourselves, our attitudes, our behaviors. Because at the end of the day, we've got to be accountable. We can't be on this consistent learning journey forever. You know, we've got to understand that we're learning, and that is going to mean that there are some people who are going to, you know, understand the conversation in a certain way. And I think the leaders of the firm, and the firm is an organization, if our understanding of issues is not correct, I think there needs to be very clear, decisive action and communication as to where the conversation should be steered, because our understanding and knowledge is quite limited on these issues. And that's partly, if not mostly, the reason why some men tend to take a step back, because now it becomes this very complicated discussion and someone then chooses to say, I don't want to be caught on the wrong end of this. So I think there needs to be emphasis that we are all learning. We're not experts on this, but we need to commit ourselves, and there should be certain milestones that we should be checking our progress on. These conversations should not be around time periods where they are convenient to have. It should be a really consistent commitment. And I think that's really when we can say we are able to gauge where we've come from and where we are going. And just one last point. It is important, again, to understand that we are not engaged in these discussions and efforts because we are here to save women. That's not it, right? There's nuances in this. I mean, many men don't really necessarily want to be on the sideline because they want to. There's cultural aspects to it. There are learned behaviors. There are issues that speak to social upbringing and backgrounds. So there's a lot of nuances that both sides really need to understand. And again, there are a lot of issues that ourselves as men have got to understand about ourselves and our mental issues.
Unfortunately, it's a human condition. Prejudice is a human condition.
It's the tragedy of the commons, right? It's this natural tendency to put yourself in a tribe and put people who are not in your tribe, whatever you define that tribe, outside it. And I certainly don't want to trivialize the challenges that trans men and transgender men and women face. And at the risk of trivializing it, a lot of it feels like it's perhaps where, you know, gay men and women were 40 years ago. Over time, it seems that things which to parts of society seem very strange become far more acceptable. You know, you can talk about visible tattoos, you know, or extra jewelry. At one stage, it would have been good grief. This is like having a folk rocker. Again, not to suggest that there aren't tremendous challenges even for gay men and women in society, in some societies in particular. So it's kind of come to grips with that. And it's no longer kind of an unusual thing. Tribe has grown. And I think in due course, if we are deliberate about cultivating tolerance for people and for differences in people and different approaches, different looks, different cultures, I think that will eventually translate, and the more evolved people will get there first, and the rest will then feel left out and have to get on board. But I think it's exactly as Gibbs said. It's fundamentally, if you have a reaction to someone, a feeling of discomfort, I think it's important to be self-aware and interrogate that within yourself. We are essentially perpetuating this sort of boys club. We're not overtly sexist anymore.
You should
hear that. It is the subtle, that just a feeling that there's been a joke made about you. No one's going to make a joke to your face anymore, because that's just frowned upon and you're going to get sued. But that feeling that people are talking about me behind my back. And I think it's those kind of things that we've got to really try. And if we do want an inclusive, respectful workplace where we can actually engage with our colleagues as colleagues and worry only about the quality of their work and their contribution to the problem that we're trying to solve for clients, for instance, to get to that point, we really have to stop this kind of identity, tribalism, jokes at other people's expense or other demographics' expense. We've got to work deliberately to take that out of our mindset. And we think it's just who we are. It's not. It's learned. And you can relearn how to think about people.
So it's a journey that centralizes the dignity of irrespective of the identity, prioritizing the agency.
And I think realizing that those who are not benefiting from certain systemic privilege, you know, are finding it more difficult. And I the irony of three dudes talking about women empowerment by ourselves is not lost on us, I guess. Yeah. But I do think that, you know, we need to just understand that our job fundamentally is to take people at face value. And so let's move together. I'd like to reframe it as all of these questions are not women's issues or trans issues or gay issues. They are human issues.
Yeah.
And we should all be working to solve them together.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Gift, for your very insightful views and comments and remarks. And I hope our audience finds it equally informative. Thank you.
The views and information expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily present those of the firm. All content is provided for general purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. We make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether expressed or implied, that the content on our podcast is accurate, complete, up-to-date, or reflects the current law. We accept no responsibility for any loss or damage, whether direct or consequential, arising from reliance on the information which is presented here.